Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/Midwestern. One more time, Dr. Kip.
www.audibletrial.com/Midwestern.
Everyone, to another edition of the Midwestern Social Scientist. This is episode 27. You are listening to Keith McIntosh and my trusted, esteemed colleague,
Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
Bum ba da bum.
Counseling psychologist.
Counseling psychologist extraordinaire.
Duke of Ohio.
Soon to be doctoral student. Mr. McIntosh, eventually Dr. McIntosh, someday in the not too distant future.
Don't count your chickens there.
Yeah, man. If something goes wrong, then I'm going to be a shit out of luck, I guess.
Yeah, it'll go right.
Hopefully.
You'll be Dr. McIntosh soon.
I'll be Dr. McIntosh someday.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Okay, folks.
Yeah.
I'm on the track to go into sociology, but this is something that I didn't know mm-hmm. I was going to go this direction in life. Long, long time ago. I thought I may be an artist, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because when I was a young child, I could scribble quite well. I could draw.
Yeah.
I made a sailboat in the fourth grade. Everybody in the whole classroom came over to my desk. They looked at my sailboat. It was very impressive.
Wow.
From that moment, moving forward, I knew I had a talent.
Yeah.
Thought about even going to an art college.
Wow.
Ended up going to a normal college, double majored in sociology and in art and design. And I guess so. Art took a back seat to sociology, but I still very much love art. I love to paint. I love to draw. Yeah. I wish I did more of it. Yeah. And we thought today, as our topic of choice, we would talk about art, the art world.
Yeah.
Why are you interested, or are you, Kip?
Art. Why am I interested in art?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I am that much. I mean, I'm interested in being creative, I guess. I'm like the opposite. I was told that I was really bad at art. I could never draw. I have terrible penmanship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so from very early on, I was never very good at art. And so I kind of always just kind of strayed away from it or did like the bare minimum to kind of get through the art classes.
Did you even have an interest in art when you started? Was it that you liked it, but you weren't good and that kind of shut you down? Or was it just never your cup of tea?
I think I liked the creative part of it, but it's like... When you're in elementary school and you're learning about art, it always seems like it's so based on your ability to like draw well. Like, okay, hey, we're gonna paint flowers, for example. So let's spend some time. Who can paint the best flowers? Well, like I'm not good at it, so mine are always like middle of the road to poor, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so it's kind of like I lose interest in watercolors because of that, because I'm not good at that initial task. So then from that point on, there's like, well, why would I ever do that again?
Yeah, you know? I feel some of that with music because I ended up really loving music and playing music.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember being tested for it, I think in the fifth grade, and doing really poorly. And I wasn't put on the track to play an instrument because mm-hmm. I wasn't good at it. I really dislike that in a lot. It is kind of sad.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. It was when it comes to art, when it comes to music, maybe athletics, you don't have to do it. So if you're not good at it, no one is really there encouraging you. Whereas if you're not good at algebra, you probably are going to have to do it anyways.
Right.
So there's like an incentive to sort of push yourself through it or for a teacher to push you through it. Whereas if you aren't good at art, immediately it's like, oh yeah, well, don't do it then.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of those people could be great artists.
Right.
You know, if they had more encouragement.
Well, and I think the thing, unlike algebra, there's not one right answer in art.
Yeah.
You know, you can be successful doing a lot of different things in art. But, I mean, if you get it kind of burned in your brain early, you're bad at art.
Yeah.
You're not going to keep going, you know?
Yeah. I guess the definition of what makes good art is pretty limited, too, when you're younger. Whereas you can do a lot of different things. You don't have to necessarily be good with your hands. I know you've said that that's kind of your weakness. You feel like when it comes to like manipulating your fingers to paint something delicate or whatever, that's something that's hard to do. But there's got to be, there's tons of art that doesn't require that.
Yeah, you know? Like I like photography and I think that's a cool form of art. I like working in Photoshop. You know, I can do that well. You know, and I can be patient and make things look right and everything. But yeah, I just think that it's like I would have never taken a photography class because that would have been an art class, which I never wanted to take.
Yeah.
And, you know, also I think you're kind of told like you should take college prep classes throughout high school. So you're not really, you know, you're kind of told early on, hey, just, you know, take biology because you're going to need that. You're not going to need photography.
Yeah. You know? I had this day in high school, and I was a senior and getting ready to, I guess not ready to graduate yet. It would have been earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. And I was in art class. And everybody in the class sort of knew that I could draw really well. Mm-hmm. I think I was considered one of the better students in the class. And we had this day where a professor from an art college in Chicago, I think it was Art Institute of Design or something, came into our high school classroom. And just walked around the classroom looking at all the desks, and we had laid out maybe like 5 or 6 drawings on our spot. And he just came and spent, you know, 30 seconds on each person evaluating their images. Mm-hmm. And then based on that, he was going to recommend maybe 1, 2, 3 students for the university.
Like, how is this formally set up? This seems really weird to me.
When I think back on it, it seems crazy, but this is exactly what happened.
Wow.
And he looked at my stuff, and I think everybody kind of expected he was going to go, oh, yours is good, like, I'll flag yours. But he just kind of glazed over it, and he didn't say anything about it. And he went to, like, the next guy, who was talented too, but not as talented, I don't think, but had stuff that was a bit more dreamy and imaginative. And he flagged his. Mm. It was a bit shocking to me. I think it was a bit surprising to everyone. And I sort of won't forget that. Because I realized at that moment, it is incredibly subjective. And even when people tend to think someone has talent, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to rise to the top. You could hit a level where one person knocks you down. And
right.
That's it.
What did that feel like when that dude like just did that to you?
It felt like unjust. Not to be egotistical, but I felt like, no, it's not just subjective. Like, it's not just that I think I'm good. Like, I've gotten feedback my whole life, and I feel like I've judging the temperature of the room, so to speak, accurately, that this is good stuff. Mm-hmm. And maybe these few pieces don't reflect that, or you need to spend more time looking at my stuff. Mm-hmm. And then plus, they have so much power at that time. Like, if he had recommended me, I don't know what it was now, if it was I don't think it was a scholarship or anything like that, but it was some, you know, kind of coaxing you in that direction. I mean, potentially, if he had flagged my stuff, I would have pursued going to Chicago and going to art school there.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you know, these people have the power to change your life.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure it's not too, like, fickle.
I mean, is there any, I mean, not to challenge you too much, but is there any chance that, like, he knew what he was talking about?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have to look at the pieces again to see. I just remember in my mind, I do remember thinking one of the pieces I included was bad. And I knew it was bad. Mm-hmm. It was just one piece that I messed up.
Yeah.
But I sort of felt like I had to put it out there because it was one piece of the 5 or 6 that we all displayed.
Yeah.
And I can imagine him seeing that one and kind of like, oh, I'm not going to include this person. Whereas, really, that was a bad example, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could flip it around, though. The person who did really well, he wasn't that interested in art. He went to like a normal college and ended up becoming a physician's assistant.
Yeah.
And doesn't do art anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm somebody who, even though I went to, you know, the normal Grand Valley State University in Michigan, I went ahead and pursued art and I still do art.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that's like indicative of something.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's maybe my first question that I'll pose to you, Keith, as Keith is kind of our resident artist here on the Midwestern Social Scientist, who has done art, has probably done more art than 99.9% of the population. He's got a basement full of paintings.
It's true.
Is there truthfully like art that's better than other art?
I think yes. But I say that with the understanding it's not a scientific endeavor. There's no way to prove anything like that.
Right.
I mean, it's completely subjective in nature. So there's no, you know, it's not as if I can put 2 paintings on a scale and somehow test them for greatness.
Right.
But I do think, and it's to the extreme degree, I don't know whether it's something you're socialized into and you learn aesthetic judgment and tastes, and then you just simply like regurgitate what you've learned. So you call something good because you've been brainwashed into thinking these elements are good. Maybe that's what's going on.
Yeah.
But if it is, that's way too deep for me to grasp. I mean, the way it feels is there are subtleties that you really require training, you know, and maybe that's part of the unfairness of it. You kind of have to go to school and have a professor show you or read a lot of books or really push yourself in a direction to understand or appreciate, oh, this is why this is considered great.
Yeah.
And this is why this is less great.
I guess I've wondered about that with, I think one of the problems is like the rules change in art a lot. So it's kind of like, it seems to me at least, I don't know, you correct me if I'm wrong, Keith, because I could be wrong. But it's like, they'll make a bunch of rules around art, like for any given time period. And then some amazing artist will come around and like, I'm going to break the rules. And then it's kind of like, if you were to see that piece of art just by itself and knew not who the author was or anything like that, or the person who made it, you'd be like, oh, that's kind of shitty.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh no, this Picasso made this at this point in art and it like changed how people thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
So then all of a sudden it becomes amazing because you have context for which it was created, you know? And that's a weird thing because it actually has nothing to do with like what has actually been put on the paper or what the photograph was or this thing that was sculpted, but it has to do with like what was happening in the world around the time.
Yeah, and that's just the nature of the beast, though. I think that's why it requires... I think that's probably true of other things, too. Like, you probably could make the case for music. Maybe some symphony came out and it was sort of groundbreaking at the time.
Well, music is art.
But it's our ears. Yeah, that's true. When we say art, though, I'm thinking more of like traditional art, like painting and sculpture and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there's two different things that happen. The one thing is that there is a kind of just... we live in a political world, as Bob Dylan said, political world. And I think what happens is there is two, three, four, five, many artists who are really talented, who are kind of doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that is remembered because they had friends in high places. Mm-hmm. They had connections. Or they were living in Paris. They were living in New York. They were somewhere where they were by museums. You know, they were sort of, they ingratiated themselves into the institution of art at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they're remembered for that reason. Whereas there are lots of other artists who were probably doing similar stuff, equally talented, but they just remain the starving artist and their stuff has been forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think there's a kind of unfairness to talking about, you know, so-and-so as this genius, when in fact it's not that they changed the world by their, you know, single-mindedness and, you know, a crazy genius. Mm-hmm. It's just that things were ripe to change and they were the one that just picked the fruit, or they were the one that's remembered for picking the fruit. With that said, I also think there are these sort of like shifts in society, and you see it in various forms. And art is like one section of society where it, you know, it's like it can, like a doctor takes your temperature or something.
Mm-hmm.
It can sort of register what's happening. So it's not a crazy. When did Sigmund Freud start publishing? Do you know?
Like late 1800s.
So I don't think it's a total coincidence that Impressionism and art that deals with how you perceive things and also with the unconscious and that kind of thing came about when our understanding of psychology kind of blossomed at the same time.
Right.
I mean, there are these sort of parallel lines that run, you know, or these movements, and they move together.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think of, say, you know, cubism was supposed to be this fracturing of space. You brought up Picasso.
Yeah.
So it's not about there's an objective world out there and the goal of the artist is just to nail down that objective world best.
Mm-hmm.
And the more like a photograph you can make it, the better. That's not the philosophy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's a different idea behind it. And it's about, you know, subjectivity and the boundaries of your subjectivity. And so I kind of like the idea that art just sort of like runs in step with society and maybe is a mirror for society and that kind of thing. But I also think that has a dead end because it's easy to look back at like the 1880s or, you know, the 1920s or something and see that. But at least for me, and this may be just the limit of my knowledge of art, there's a kind of end in maybe the 1950s or 60s, where after that, there are these periods, but they strike me as more like fads.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like people say, oh, the 80s had a certain kind of fashion, or people in the 70s were into this kind of music or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I kind of feel like the art for the past half century has been like that. Like, oh, the 70s were kind of like this, and the 80s were kind of like that.
Yeah.
But I don't really feel like it's somehow deeper. Whereas Picasso is a great example, or Monet is another good example, Van Gogh. These are people who I think really were sort of mirroring something deeper, reflecting something deeper in society. Yeah.
Well, and I think, you know, I want to not just get it too much into, I think maybe, Keith, just because of what the type of art you do, we tend to think of like painting or more traditional forms. But I mean, there's also dance, you know, which is a form of art. There's acting, you know?
Yeah.
Then there's any type of performance art, you know?
Totally.
There's like graffiti.
That's a really interesting thing.
Yeah, it's like with Banksy and everything, like in England, and now he's come to like New York a few times and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's really, really like cool art and kind of says something about the country, and he makes like political statements. Yeah. There's also like comic book artists, you know, and people who make like even like Saturday morning like funny pictures, you know, or funny, what do you call it, like comics.
You know?
Like there's a lot of different ways art is utilized in addition to... like, just like, hey, everybody come look at this, you know? Or even branding, you know, and advertising.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge thing, the power of the brand. Because that really defines our era in a huge way. Post, I guess, World War II, you know, 1950s to today, the power of the brand. I think that's something art has dealt with, but maybe not all that successfully.
Yeah.
Probably could deal with it more or in a smarter way.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's more the territory for novelists and stuff, too.
Yeah.
Which is another kind of art.
Yeah, writing, right, is another form of art.
Yeah.
Do you think that if everybody was basically made to take, like, a year of art, like, our world would improve?
I think, I wouldn't say our world would improve, but I think art is a pretty important release, or it can be if you learn how to do it. It doesn't mean you have to be good at it. You can be horrible at it, but you can enjoy it still.
Mm-hmm.
I think if everybody had to take it... quite a few of those people would find they have some enjoyment or some skill, and that would be, I don't know, like fulfilling for those people, which should be a good thing.
Well, because I wonder about, you know, if there's nothing more fundamental about how we understand the world around it, it's like we look out our eyeballs at the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's our little way of like interacting with it. I mean, the most bare bones way is seeing the world. And when I think about what art basically is, it's like, hey, this is interesting to my eyeballs and to my brain, you know, and it can be a McDonald's sign and that like stimulates like a symbol, you know, it's like, oh, there's food, you know, or it can be like, oh, something sexual, like, oh, that's like got curves and it like is a sexy kind of thing. Or it can be like interesting or weird, or like the colors can remind you of like, oh, that looks fresh. It can like evoke a feeling.
Yeah.
And it just seems like the fact that most people have not even a basic understanding of any visual design of like how you make something pleasing to the main, to our eyeballs is really insane to me. I mean, you obviously need like to know how to do math and everything else, but that's kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. And the idea that behind that there is a kind of system, like with music, you know, it can just seem overwhelming at first, but you can learn to read music and you can learn the theory behind it. And it's like, it is a kind of math, you know, things fit together mathematically. And art is a bit like that too, in terms of complementary colors and the reason certain colors are pleasing next to each other, or how colors change in relation.
Yeah.
They're not static. So, you know, the same blue doesn't appear the same if it's put next to a green compared to if it's put next to an orange or a white or a black. Things change, so they sort of affect each other. And just, you know what, how I guess I view art as the kind of adult version of being like a little kid playing in the mud and just kind of being like natural and like exploring your world and just experiencing the way things look and smell and taste and the whole thing, you know, just kind of being in the world. Yeah, you grow up and you put on a suit and a tie and you live in a kind of like sterile world. Everything's very clean and you get in your car and you go to work and you come home. And art is one place where you just take, paint is dirt, you know, it's refined dirt basically. And you're smearing just these colors around and mixing them and plopping them on.
Yeah.
And you usually get dirty in the process. And it seems to me there's something kind of animal, you know, kind of primal about that, but that's very healthy. And for me, it's like a bit of a release, you know, it's hard work too, but it's a kind of, you know, getting something out, I feel like. And it seems to me a good thing for people to experience that.
Mm-hmm.
And these days with yoga and all this, you know, all this stuff, all this, you know, hippie BS that people love so much, I don't see why art couldn't be a part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I believe, I mean, there's art therapy, you know?
Yeah. I don't know anything about that really.
Yeah. And I've done it. I mean, I've done art therapy with people and... you know, it's essentially what you just said, that it's expressing yourself through art, you know,
yeah.
And expressing yourself is good. That's one of our like core rules in mental health, you know, complementary colors go well together. Mental health, expressing yourself is good. So
how does that work when you sit down with somebody with a blank page and you give them a pen, or what do you do?
Well, it's a lot of like throwing paint at people.
You know? Really?
No. Well, I mean, realistically,
it's like it's the Jackson Pollock kind of drip.
I think it would be like the equivalent of doing any intro to art class, except there's no rules. So it's like, I'll give them the ability to do art. So I'll give them paper and I'll give them markers. Yeah. Or I'll give them, you know, a camera, or you give them like musical instruments or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you just tell them like, hey, do this and don't worry what people are thinking. Try to not be judged by it. And just make something that expresses something that you're feeling. You know?
Is it hard for people to get started at first?
Yeah. So sometimes it's really helpful to like kind of start and be like, here's what I'm making and here's what I'm feeling and here's what I'm thinking, and kind of give them the, like, if you give people a format
mm-hmm.
to like make the art,
mm-hmm.
they usually do better. It's really bad. Like a really poor art therapist, I think, just walks in a room with like a ton of art supplies and it's like, have fun.
Yeah.
Like you got to give people some direction and give them like, here's kind of what we're thinking. You can't just like open the world wide open, because you want them to express something, you know. And sometimes it's helpful if they like kind of, you kind of identify like, hey, you know, we're working on this depression. I want you to draw what your depression looks like.
That sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. You know, or just draw what anxiety looks like for you,
yeah.
You know, when you're about to go take your organic chem test.
Yeah, I guess it's probably fair to say when they're done, you don't grade them on their drawing.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely not. And you know what I'll often do when I would do it is I would talk about all the things I appreciated about it and how it inspired me and made me think about my own depression or anxiety or whatever. I'm not saying I'm depressed, mm-hmm. but like mm-hmm. my own thoughts around depression and everything. So
sounds great. Yeah, it just reminded me of high school again, the grading of art seems very odd to me now.
Yeah.
I remember this one student, he was, you know, talented, I guess, but he messed up on one of his drawings. He drew a landscape.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the 12th grade. I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he drew the sun,
mm-hmm.
and he shaded it in like a pool ball or something, mm-hmm. like as if one side of the sun is going to have the sun on it and the other side is going to be in the shade.
Yeah.
And he just wasn't thinking.
Yeah.
And the teacher, we had a very, very strange art teacher. Did you have a strange art teacher, or were they nice?
We had a very pretty art teacher.
Oh.
Like, very beautiful.
Did that encourage the boys to take art?
It often encouraged the boys to do a lot of things, I think. I'm not going to talk about
whether or not we want to call it art, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
This is back to the Jackson Pollock splatter paintings.
Yeah.
And she goes over to his drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a way of kind of had her hands up like in fists and kind of mm-hmm. held them like a rabbit close to her chest. And she kind of like take one finger down like a Disney evil witch kind of mm-hmm. like point. So she kind of, you know, put her finger down towards his drawing. And she just said the obvious, which was he shouldn't have shaded the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy must have been going through a lot of shit in his life. I mean, mm-hmm. he, you just see the tension in his body. He wanted to explode and wow. she gave him a reason to explode. So he flips out. He starts yelling and screaming and F this and F that. And he takes the drawing that he'd carefully made and he rips the sun out of the drawing and crumples it up and throws it on the table. And then he storms off and he gets to the door and he wants to slam it as like kind of an exclamation mark for his you know, action. But there was a little stud in the door, so it couldn't slam. So it kind of just squeaked, you know, and then everybody laughed, which was horrible because he wanted people to be afraid of him.
Yeah.
So he storms down the hall. The teacher kind of made fun of him in a way, made fun of the situation, because I guess mm-hmm. this kid was kind of notorious for being violent.
Mm-hmm.
So she was saying she was ready to grab another student to defend her as a shield, you know, so that he wouldn't hit her.
That's a really terrible thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, it was a joke, but it was probably inappropriate looking back on it now. And I was left with the appreciation that art class, for me, was a source of pride and fun, but for a lot of people, it can be not a good experience. Yeah.
Can I tell you a story?
Please
about it?
Do, yeah.
Well, first of all, I think it's amazing that in itself was kind of performance art.
Yeah.
Like shading the sun, which is supposed to be this bright thing, ripping it out and then like slamming it down and then like closing the door. Like that scene itself could be in a museum. You
That's
know?
Funny, yeah.
Called like the Black Sun, but it's spelled like S-O-N, you know? That's what I would do. I had this, I was in sixth grade and this was very traumatic for me. I'll never forget this. I had been very like bad at drawing, you know, like always consistently really, really bad. And so one of the things that I kind of leaned on, you know, to get better at drawing was, like, I would just draw very, like, straight lines with, like, a ruler, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, like, I can't draw well and, like, my lines never look straight or anything. So I'm going to take out, like, a ruler and, like, draw with, like, lines with a ruler, you know? And so I remember that I drew this thing where I drew, like, a grid, basically, on a piece of paper. Like, a big tic-tac-toe board, pretty much on one piece of paper. And then in the middle of it, I had, like, drawn a circle, and it was, like, a yin-yang. And then, but I turned the yin-yang into, like, a comet.
Hmm.
So it was a grid with a yin-yang, but yeah. The yin-yang was, like, a comet. Like, it was shooting across the grid.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And I, like, really, like, was spending a lot of time on this, and I was, like, drawing it with a pencil, and I was, like, trying to do, like, shading, which I was really bad at and everything. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, oh, well, this, like, really looks... you know, really looks good. And, like, I was, like, really proud of it. And I was, like, this is, like, one of the best things that, like, I've ever drawn. And the art teacher at the time, this was not the pretty art teacher, this is an art teacher we had before, she walked over and she was just, like, this is terrible.
Really?
And she said that to me. Like, she was,
just
like
that?
Yeah, like, she thought from her perspective that I was just, like, screwing around.
Really?
You know, like, yeah, like, wasn't, like, trying. And I was trying really, really hard.
Yeah.
And I remember I, like, started crying, you know, because I had really worked hard on it.
How old were you? Was, like, elementary school?
Yeah, sixth grade. Yeah, so sixth I don't know grade. How old are you, in, like, 10 or 11,
yeah,
you know?
Probably 11, 10 or 11.
And I remember I ripped it up
yeah.
right there. I, like, put it in my, I, like, just crumpled like it into a yeah. bottle. Yeah. Because I felt like I was being creative. I was, like, thinking about, like, the lines, and I was trying to make the comet thing, like, yeah. like, intersect with the grid at, like, different points and stuff. And yeah, this teacher just, like, shit on it.
This stuff scars you for life, man.
Yeah, because really from does. That point on, I didn't care about that class. Like, I did, like, the absolute bare minimum,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. If you if she had come over and complimented your work, would that have, like, kind of, like, lit a fire under you in
I
terms
think
of
it
wanting
would've.
To
like,
draw
like, I
more?
Think, yeah, like, I think I would have been like, oh, this is, like, a thing I can do now. It's, like, use this ruler and all that, like, yeah, you know, do all yeah. that kind of stuff. But I couldn't, you know?
Yeah, I think probably that happens to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's too bad. It's really stupid that at such a young age we would shut anybody down for drawing. Mm-hmm. It's one thing if you're adding incorrectly, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Or if you are doing yeah. bad in geography.
Yeah.
It's a different thing if you're experimenting with drawing with a friggin' ruler and you're shut down because of it.
But I don't think it was that she was sitting there, like, trying to shut me down. I think that I was probably, like, a loud talker, you know, and, like, a louder student in class and somebody who got in trouble occasionally. You know?
Yep.
And that she probably was like, he's just goofing around, not trying, you know, and came over to me and she misinterpreted what I was like, my behavior
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, I felt very, like, shut down and, like, gave up on art pretty much, you know?
Yeah, I wonder if it hadn't happened that way, if the ruler would have been a kind of, like, doorway to doing more art, because mm-hmm. it is a sort of a powerful tool in terms mm-hmm. of making, say, like, everything is according to a certain perspective, like, you know, two-point perspective. I don't know if you remember that from art class, where you draw mm-hmm. a horizon line, you put two mm-hmm. points on the horizon, and then, say, you can draw a hallway or a city street and all the different lines of, like, the floor, the sidewalk, the road, all go
yeah.
to this horizon point.
No, I have
point.
No idea what you're talking about. But
well, anyways, you need a ruler to do that.
yeah.
It's all about using a ruler. Everything, basically, is guided by a ruler. So
yeah.
it's I can imagine you know, doing stuff like that quite well if you hadn't gotten
well,
shut
down.
Well,
and I think I just really liked art that had, like, straight lines and bright colors.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, you know, like, that traditional Japanese flag where it's, like, a red or yellow sun with, like, red and white
yeah.
shooting out? Like, I always loved that, and that's kind of, like, what it was inspiring me at that time,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
To draw that, as I just liked anything like that. I thought it was cool.
Why the yin yang symbol?
I think it was just like the early late 90s or early 90s or middle 90s, and yin yangs were really popular.
Was that what it was, or was there something more to it? Like, you were really drawn to that image for some reason.
I think it was more that, like, yin yangs were kind of the cool thing for, like, I remember, like,
yeah.
we had, like, rings and jewelry and necklaces with yin yangs and stuff. I think it was just that. I don't think I was attracted to. I mean, maybe I was. I don't know.
It's just interesting because I remember looking at that symbol a lot and thinking it was really cool. Just because it's called penetration is the actual art term
yeah.
for, like, there's that black dot in the white and the white
yeah.
dot in the black. And it's kind of funny to me because as an adult now, the idea of, like, the Tao and reading a bit about Eastern philosophy,
mm-hmm.
like, that symbol represents that. And I think it's kind of interesting that when I was younger, that visual symbol stood out as compelling.
Yeah.
And then as an adult, the ideas behind it I found compelling.
Right.
I wonder if that was going on with you too, or if it was just coincidence.
No, I think, yeah, maybe. I mean, what, you know, I remember owning like a yin yang necklace. I'm like, what made me buy it? You know?
Yeah.
I think it just, it was like a very, like, I think hip hop and everything. It was kind of like the eight ball was like a really popular symbol for a little while.
Yeah.
Like,
forget about that.
And there's stuff like that. I think it just became like one of those logos that was kind of associated with coolness.
I just remember those. You have a great memory. I just remember I guess it was like a magic eight ball, and you
shake it up. Yeah, shake it up. Questions.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. I had one of those.
But also, people like on the back of their jackets, they would have like an eight ball and stuff. There was like a time where that was popular.
Yeah.
So, but okay. So Keith, another question I have that goes back to something you said earlier for you is: what are some of the other rules of art? Like, what makes something aesthetically pleasing? So you said like complementary colors. I always thought like contrasting colors also looked good together.
One of the main and this is coming from a painter, so everything I say is I'm really thinking about painting and drawing to a lesser extent.
Mm-hmm.
The black and white scheme, the structure of it, and then in terms of black and white, the contrast, like as you say, that's hugely important. So if you fill up a whole canvas full of light yellow and red and orange, and it's all really pretty looking, it's not going to be very interesting because it's like it's all going to be the same regardless of how pretty it is. So you want to imagine you're colorblind and you can only see black and white, and you're judging paintings like that way.
Yeah,
you still want to create a painting with an interesting structure. Actually, that yin yang symbol. If like imagine a painting where half of it is black, but there's and half of it's white, but then there's a piece of it is. But imagine it's like a hill of a yellow daisies. That's the light part. Mm-hmm. But there's a house on the hill, and that's like painted dark brown, and that's the dark part. And then the sky is dark blue, and that's the dark. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Maybe a big white cloud.
Yeah.
So you don't think about it because you see the color. So you're looking at the subject matter and the color. But there's actually just this underlying structure of black and white, and that's hugely important.
Right. So what are So that's one rule. Well, and you know it's cool. I remember reading this. There's this guy Ramachandran. He's like one of the most famous neuropsychologists in the world.
Okay.
And he wrote a book on art. I read the book, and it was about like why our brain is attracted to certain things.
Yeah.
And it said one of the reasons that our brain is so attracted to like contrasting colors is because fruit always contrasts like the tree it grows on.
Ooh.
So like berries and apples are red and they contrast green.
Ah.
So that's like aesthetically pleasing to us.
Yeah.
You know? Because if you can spot that, and it goes back to like originally we were all colorblind, and then a couple freak humans like had like the like could see colors, and all of a sudden they survived because they could see the fruit.
I didn't know that. So are you saying like chimpanzees and stuff are colorblind?
Yeah, I think they are. Most animals are colorblind. Like we and birds. Like birds have like a whole nut. Like we have, I think it's called like triscopic vision or something. Like we can see red, yellow, and green. You know.
Yeah.
And like the variations of that. And then, like, animals can usually only see two of those, but birds can see, like, the, what do they call it, like, the other colors that we can't see.
Yeah.
Like, the ultraviolet colors or whatever
it is. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, there's, like, the electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
Just, you know, jiggling everywhere.
And I'm not an expert on this. I just read a book on it. So the Ramachandran pretty much says, like, that is, like, an attractive thing. And then there's, like, certain colors that humans are just drawn to, kind of. So, like, he gives an example, like, of a parallel animal. So, like, seagulls, mother seagulls, I have a little red dot on their nose, right? And so baby seagulls, like, when you show them the color red, they get really excited. Like, that's an inherent thing about their brain because they know, like, food is coming because the mom's beak has this red. Well, the interesting thing was some really smart psychologist or biologist or whatever somewhere thought, well, what if we exaggerate red? Like, what if we come up with like the brightest red and it's usually a circle. What if we do like five circles and show that all to the baby bird? And the baby bird got even more excited.
Yeah.
So they kind of extrapolated that idea to humans. And so one like visual that they know that humans are like attracted to is like the female form. You know, like curves, breasts, like curves of hips. And that's why they think in a lot of like Hindu art, the curves and the hips and the breasts are like really exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same idea that we are like, it's like something we're already attracted to, but then exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And if that gets exaggerated, like it evokes this natural stimulus from us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we like, so that has translated to art, and that's what makes good art.
Is that last part supposed to be erotic in nature or more just general?
Well, he just picks up like what a natural human instinct was and how it plays into art. So it's not the inherent like erotic thing. It's just like women look at women's bodies for social comparison, and that's kind of the natural thing. And then men look at it for like reproductive value.
Yeah.
So if you make it either like more threatening or more, you know, more like beautiful or whatever, then it's like
it's fascinating. It really is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It also kind of takes the air out of my balloon a little bit, because you think of it as it being I don't know, in the realm of like poetry, and it's this very high level human thing, and only humans do it. And that's true, of course, but to learn the evolutionary background for it, it kind of like makes it seem less romantic, you know, less interesting. It's just like, oh yeah, I respond to this for very practical reasons, not because of some high level thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both though. I mean, what, you know, so let's say I look at the Hindu goddess and I feel that like, I feel that like, oh, that's like, more interesting to me to look at. What I do with that feeling from there is, you know, the high level stuff, you know, I mean, in the same way that your eyeballs have to see the art, you know, it's your brain has to like, be like interested by things that are visually appealing.
Yeah. There's a quality I was just thinking about before you mentioned like different types of art, and you said like comics and stuff. And I think sometimes stuff like that can be art, but I also think sometimes it's just like a different, like there's, is it Dilbert kind of comic in the actual newspaper?
Yeah.
And it's like super simplistic.
Yeah.
So really it only exists for the dialogue, which is usually pretty clever. And there might be social commentary or some interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just like a way for the cartoonist to say something interesting. It's not that the drawings are of any great value. So there's
the guy who draws Dilbert is crying right now as he's listening to this. He's like, ironically, he's sitting in an office.
Yeah.
Like reading. And then like this is a Dilbert comic. And like, I was talking about this. He's like listening to it while he's trying to draw Dilbert. Being like, the Dilbert drawing is really inconsequential compared to the dialogue. And then he starts crying.
You just see like a teardrop on top of the comic.
Yeah.
Whereas when I think of real art, I think of, I think of the process of making art because I do it myself. And when it's good, you kind of get lost in it for a minute. So you're like in the zone, you know, it's like that familiar flow state where your skills are being tested because you're really pushing the boundary and you're really loving it too. So your enjoyment, you're getting sucked into the pleasure, and then you're also being challenged, and you kind of like lose sense of yourself, and you are in this kind of like other place that you get maybe when you play sports, when you exercise, you know, when you do play music, when you do other things like that, where you're really in the zone. And it's kind of physical thing too. Even though it's like painting and it doesn't seem physical, when I paint, I'm usually like walking around. Maybe I've got music on, maybe I don't, but I'm definitely like moving. I'm like always moving. It feels like a physical thing. And I think of Jackson Pollock, like he'd be a great example of someone who's constantly moving around, you know, throwing. It's like this very kind of masculine, violent kind of like whoosh, 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 paint going everywhere. And that to me is real art. When you're doing something with great physicality at a high level. And sometimes I feel a little bit, I kind of put my nose in the air when people say something's art that clearly doesn't require like anything like that, when it's like a Dilbert comic. And it's just like, I can see it's not that it's something other than art. It's a kind of art, but it's not what I think of when I think of art.
Right. But see, I think we're Dilbert and maybe like, you know, those YouTube videos of people taking a picture of themselves every day for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's also something to be said for like the consistency of doing art, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's kind of like the YouTube thing. It's like, obviously taking a picture of yourself is not that like amazing, but to take the same picture of yourself for like 15 years every day is kind of art. That's the, like the persistent determination of that. And same thing with Dilbert, you know, if you're making a new Dilbert comic every day, like there's something about like creating a world and creating a story and creating characters and like seeing how those characters interact with different social, because you're taking some of the kind of social commentary you want to make, but you have to make your characters fit into it, you know? And I think that's the art, is about the creating of the universe as opposed to any given comic, you know?
Yeah.
Am I wrong on that?
No, you're right. It just, it's, I guess what I'm expressing is my quirk or my experience, which is like, remember back to being a kid playing in the mud, that kind of thing. That's my relationship to it. So, like, taking it, that's a great example, taking a picture every day for years and years, because that is totally an art project, and it's really interesting, and stuff like that is great. Or the Dilbert comic is definitely, like, a great place for social commentary. But that is a different kind of It's almost more of like the art of a novelist, where you're observing your world and you're commenting on it. You're creating this other universe, yeah, or something like that. It doesn't require any, like, the typing at the, you know, the keyboard,
yeah,
or the typewriter or whatever it is you're using. That doesn't really matter so much. It's, yeah, the world you're creating, and that's very distinct from being covered in paint or sawdust or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I agree. And that brings up like some other forms of art, you know, which is like, is woodworking art?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I would say it is.
Yeah.
Or how about, I just had another one in my head. I lost it, though. Woodworking and...
Or maybe a craft.
Yeah.
Certainly takes artistic ability to do that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. One, being able to visualize something before you create it.
Yeah.
You know? It's just more functional. You know, it's like, yeah, you're creating something functional as opposed to, you know.
Do you think that's missing from modern life? Because, yeah, back in the day, the contraptions that, you know, filled our lives up were simple enough that we could kind of understand them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know what a good example, like a typewriter. It might be complicated, yeah, but you, if it broke,
yeah,
you probably could just look at it long enough and figure, right, out what you need to do to fix it.
Yeah.
Whereas I have no ability to fix a computer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all this stuff in my life, it's so complicated now. I can't see in, mm-hmm, into it or whatever. So, and I work in, you know, work in an office where I'm using these machines, and, mm-hmm, it's not about understanding how they work. Whereas back in the day,
yeah,
being a carpenter, right, making, yeah, cabinets, blacksmith, all that kind of stuff, that was what was normal.
Well, and I guess another thing, I guess, is maybe we're asking the wrong question here, because maybe it's just using artistic ideas in products. You know, like, I think about looking at the back of your MacBook right now,
yeah,
and there's obviously, like, a minimalist thing, yeah, going on. You know what I mean? And that's an artistic idea being applied to something to make it more aesthetically pleasing. You know, in, yeah, the same way that our iPhone, like, looks really beautiful. Like, if you look at it when you first get it out of the box, yeah, it's like, wow, this is like a very pretty looking thing.
The design of it.
But versus you look at a BlackBerry and it's kind of like ugly. You know what I mean?
But that's just like how many people worked on making that that way?
Yeah, to make it be, that's what I mean. I'm saying that's not, it's not whether or not an iPhone is art. It's, well, parts of the iPhone are art. You know, because, mm-hmm, they, like, the symbol, like, the logo, somebody, like, made that and thought, put a lot of time into it.
Yeah,
know?
But what I'm saying is, on a mass scale, I don't think people today have the opportunity to sort of create something the way they did back then in terms of making cabinets and all this stuff. Because, yeah, we've gotten so sophisticated with our ability to manufacture things on such a mass scale using robots and using, like, other means, that kind of, like, hand touch is, mm-hmm, I think, absent.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's that was probably a way that a lot of people had some kind of artistic release that maybe they don't have these days.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as I'm thinking about this, more and more, like, I don't know, more and more art things are popping into my brain. Like, film.
Yeah.
Is an art.
Totally. And that's a really great one, yeah, because it's tricky, because it hundreds of people are need, yeah, to work on a film. So it's kind of like, okay, yeah, yeah, it's a director's vision, but it's also like an actor and then the cinematographer.
And the costume designer and like the and set designer and the lighting person's vision and, yeah, everybody.
Yeah.
And another one like that is video games. Are video games art? And I think they are.
Yeah, I was thinking about that before.
And it's the most interesting form of art in its own way, in a weird way. Because it's the only art that you take an active, you actively participate in it.
Yeah, you change it, or you control like what you experience in it.
Right, like, so somebody, it's the only time somebody creates, it's like if somebody created a painting with rules, like, here's the, it has to be cubism or whatever.
Yeah.
And then from there, they're like, okay, now you make the painting as you look at it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's a really bizarre thing when you think about it.
It is. It's super strange. And it's kind of brand new. I don't know if there's any analog to that in the past. It requires, you know, high-tech computers. It requires, like, machines that work on a high level,
mm-hmm,
to do it. It's crazy that, I mean, you look at the early video games from the 80s or the 90s compared to what we have now. That, mm-hmm, was not that long ago. I mean, it was just like, you know, a decade or so ago. Mm-hmm. And we're living in like a different era when it comes to that.
Yeah.
It's just psychologically to be in that world with the, you know, the atmosphere and just how complicated it is.
Yeah.
It seems like a really bizarre, interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. Like, we're talking about integrating it into products and, you know, all that kind of stuff in the video games and all this. It is really weird how, like, art has gone from, hey, let's go to a trip to the museum to see the art. And now instead, it's like, let's look at my phone for the art. Let's,
yeah,
look, it's like all around us, because all these artistic ideas ideas have been integrated into so much branding and like cabinetry and, you know, how a table looks. And, you know, it's like it's no longer art is something that's by itself somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's all around us all the time.
Yeah. The flip side to the masses, maybe not using creativity in their everyday lives, is that design is such mm-hmm. a major part of everything now in a way that it really wasn't back in the day or not so long ago.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, everything is about design. Of course, the, you know, Apple computers are all about design, but
yeah.
Beats by Dre headphones, everything has got design. And it, yeah. I guess it conveys aesthetic principles. That's an important part of our objects these days, having yeah. an aesthetic principle and sort of conveying a certain look, a certain vibe.
Whereas, and if it's done poorly, we think the product is cheap.
Yeah.
You know, if something looks aesthetically stupid, we're like, oh, this is like poor, or like my probably doesn't work well, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if there's not icing on the cake or something, like it wasn't totally finished, you know?
Yeah.
If it was really a good product, at the end they would have taken time to design it properly yeah. and make it aesthetically pleasing. And if it's not, then it's questionable.
Yeah.
Do you think art reflects, like I was describing earlier, these different eras and art maybe is a kind of mirror for other things taking place in society? Does that register yeah, these days?
You know, or? Where the one area I see like, that is very paralleled is fashion.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, is I think in fashion, art is very well paralleled what's going on in the society. So, like, I think about like women's sexual revolution.
Yeah.
And then like clothes changing to reflect yeah. that, or women being able to go to work and take on like more fat, like take on more roles that men had traditionally have, mm-hmm. and therefore wearing more masculine clothing, mm-hmm. you know? Or I think about music and how that influences clothing, mm-hmm. you know? And so, yeah, I think that fashion is like a very, very clear example of how, you know, art can parallel society and society can parallel art. You
yeah,
know?
I think that's a great insight. In fact, just yeah. the other day I was looking at something online and they showed women's fashion for every decade, going back to like the 1870s or something mm-hmm. like that. And it was kind of funny because you could see the gradual change from the 1870s to the 80s to the 90s. Mm-hmm. It's not something I ever paid attention to before, mm-hmm. but you could totally see the similarities and it was kind of changing and going in a certain direction. And then there's this rupture, which was the 1960s.
Yeah.
All of a sudden the skirts are way shorter. It was like this totally different era.
Yeah.
So it definitely reveals the sort of revolutionary period.
Well, and even the colors, you know, think about like poodle skirts and like these very soft, light colors. And then all of a sudden people were wearing like beatnik shit and like
yeah.
bright colors and like wearing flowers on their hair and like everything's like and very drug influence too, you know?
Revolution.
Yeah.
Didn't really work out though, did it?
Yeah. Well, and just being brash and drawing attention to yourself. That was like the first time I think really that was like valued, you know?
I guess there was the kind of 1920s flapper.
Oh, yeah.
That was sort of like an early version of it. Yeah. It was kind of on. It was sort of coming, you know, but then the Great Depression sort of kept it at bay.
World War.
You know, it was almost put on pause or something. Yeah. It was in the canon.
That's funny.
Oh, just how do you, in the same way that fashion or maybe music reflects society, and we can see it clearly back then, probably because we have distance, do you think there's any insight to be gained now from the current music, from current styles?
Yeah, I think, well, and we've talked about this before, so I don't want to belabor a point. If you really want to hear more about this, listen to our hipster episode. But I think we ultimately use art on our bodies, on ourselves, and what we choose to wear to convey things about ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, so they become symbols. So if you have cat-rimmed glasses or whatever they're called, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
I know what you're saying.
It's like it kind of like indicates certain things about yourself. Like if you wear overalls, you know, it kind of conveys something. If you wear a bandana, it conveys something about yourself.
What does the bandana convey?
That you like Bruce Springsteen.
Okay. Because I wear a bandana sometimes.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Where'd you get that idea?
I got that idea from a friend of mine.
Oh, okay. That's me. So Keith wants to be like me, so he wears a bandana like I do.
Be like Bruce.
Yeah, everybody wants to be like Bruce.
Everybody wants to be like Bruce.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen, great artist.
Because Bruce is just like everybody.
Yeah. So that got us really off topic. What were you saying?
You were just complimenting me on my hairdo.
Oh yeah, you're really a good looking guy, Keith.
All right, thanks.
I have a question.
Yeah.
What about? I think another thing, sort of like we talked about veganism last week, you know, mm-hmm. there's also something about art that is inherently kind of highbrow, you know?
Ah.
And I think that there's like a kind of a, Then remember Pierre Bourdieu did that like study looking at art, and he like found that like low income people think like everything's art. Middle class people like are very particular about like what's art and what's not, and then like rich people don't care. I don't know if you ever, there's like this sociology study that's like kind of famous for the school we went to, because our various sociology and art are blurred in our program. But yeah, there's this famous study where they looked at how different social classes of group look at art.
Yeah, he was a great, he's probably the best French sociologist of the century or so.
Being the best French, so that's kind of like being the toughest Smurf.
I don't know about that. I think France, they're way into philosophy and stuff. That's like, you know, being the, that's being like Mike Tyson of wrestling.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, he has the idea of the habitus, Bourdieu, and it's like the kind of, it's the social world you live in and where you feel comfortable. So maybe if you're poor, but you go to like an art show, like a gallery opening, you'd feel uncomfortable. Because it's sort of not where you belong. So it refers to sort of the places you feel like you fit in. And he was just describing how middle-class people willfully try to, you know, gain sort of culture points by understanding and paying homage
cultural
to...
Cultural capital
or to high art. Yeah, totally. I mean, there's a there is a kind of division there. And that's the case with a lot of things in life, where if you have more money or you have more free time, you're able to, you know, indulge in things like art or music or maybe cooking and stuff, you know, things that you don't have the time or energy or money to do if you don't have it. So art is definitely one of those things, going to the gallery.
But what is it about, like, do you think it's more that middle class people kind of want to be viewed as like, or upper class, middle class people like want to know about art? Or do you think it's like that they just happen to be privy to that information when they're boarding schools and they're private schools? Versus like, or do you think it's more like a rejection, like low income people being like, this is stupid. Like, why would I go sit in a museum?
I don't think low income people are rejecting it at all. I think they would like to sort of know more about it, or, you know, it's something they'd like to investigate. But I think it's more just the practicality of life. I think like a middle class existence kind of lends itself to having the time or the money or whatever it happens to be to go to the, go see a play, or to go to an art museum, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I think middle-class people, it's a combination of a sincere interest with just a kind of, you're taught this is something to value.
Yeah.
So even if you kind of secretly don't like it, you might take your kid to the museum to make sure that they see these paintings and they know what this is and that this is something that's valued.
Yeah. See, I don't know. I disagree a little bit. I do think that there's like a rejection of those kinds of things in low-income communities. Because the idea, for example, that you'd spend like $5,000 on a painting is very like for, as a person who grew up very poor, like myself, makes me want to throw up. Like, it's like, wow, what a waste of money that is. Like, just to have something you're going to look at, you know? So it like goes against your practical instincts of being like, you should value what you have and not kind of give in to decadence, you know? And so that's where I think it comes. I almost think about country music. Whenever country music is like, I don't need no fancy Victoria's Secret. Like, I can just go to Walmart and get the same damn thing, you know? Or like, oh, all I need is a good old pair of Levi's and a pickup truck, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of that same idea.
Yeah, you know? I can see that. Yeah, I guess I just don't. I guess to say the opposite, it makes me feel a bit like, I'm shutting, like, oh, they just don't get it, and they're just like stupidly rejecting it. You know what I mean? I don't want to. To me, I want to give them sort of the credit, and if they're not into it, I want to believe that it's because of reasons that are not due to them.
Right, but I think it's a reaction to the culture points thing. I don't think it's like.
What if it's like you give the example of a painting that you'd sell for $5,000? What if there's a painting that's a $2 million painting, you know, it's like just this ridiculous extreme, but it's sitting there for free. There's a museum that gives you free entry. I mean, do you think the average working class or poor person would be interested in, oh, my tax money goes to this museum, I'm going to go and see this painting because I, in some ways, I own it?
No.
They would not.
Well, I mean, if we lived in a fictitious world, maybe where they had time to do it and stuff, maybe. I think that if you gave them the choice between that and watching their favorite football team on a Sunday morning, they're going to pick the football team. In fact, I bet you they would pay $20 to watch the football game instead of go to the art museum.
And that's probably true of most people in general, though.
Yeah. Well, maybe. But I think it goes back to that thing. I think the low-income people's rejection of art does not come from a choice that they're making. I think it comes from the middle class people using it as a culture point to distance themselves from the poor people.
So this is something, this is a point in our column and something we get, and you just don't get it because you're not included in our
group.
And
so when you go into a situation and you don't know who Monet is, you know, for example, you're like, who is that? Like, and everyone else is like, oh, it's an artist. Like, and then you feel very stupid. Versus if you ask them, like the middle class people, like, oh, do you know how to put together a transmission? You know, they'd be like, what's a no? I just have my mechanic do that. You know what I mean? It's these clear, like, class differences start coming out. And I think when people of low-income backgrounds are made to feel stupid, they reject things and they value the things that they can do, you know?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. The only, like, addition to that is, it is a kind of great thing that a city comes together as a, it's a kind of a communist idea. We're all going to pool our resources in the form of taxes. And in addition to, like, you know, garbage men and those kinds of things, we're also going to build museums. And we can get a, maybe somebody will donate a ton of money. So we have these great paintings and pieces of art. And it's open to the public. And maybe on Saturday, let's say Saturday, it is free. It's a great resource. Everybody in the community has created this museum. And in a certain sense, everybody owns these paintings. And it seems a shame that that isn't sort of accessed more widely, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think we're talking about two different things. One is, like, the ability to go and do something on the weekend that involves art, and the ability to go purchase art, I think, are two very different things, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't, I'm not really sure. Another funny thing about that kind of thing is, like, the commoditization of art. Like, art, the fact that you can, like, Target has an entire art section now of, like, things you can buy and, like, put on your wall.
That's a really great point. There is this weird... kind of like middle class, it's like a cheap version of something that otherwise would be very highbrow.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Manufacturing art.
Who is the guy that we learned about in the
class? Thomas Kincaid.
Yeah, Kincaid, who, like, I'm glad you knew exactly where I was going with this, but essentially this Kincaid guy, he paints these very generic American-centric, like, landscapes where it's, like, all, like, mountains, purple mountains majesty and, like, and, like, rivers and, like, American flags and everything. And then he, like, will... put a little highlight on each one to make it unique and then mass produces them. And what was that called? Like affirmative culture?
Yeah.
Affirmative versus, what was the other thing?
Negative function.
Negative function. Affirmative culture and negative function.
Yeah.
Even I mean, his, for Batani. It was Marshall Batani for teaching us this. If you're listening, Marshall Batani, way to go to you.
Yeah. It's kind of a brilliant move as a businessman. He has these mass produced paintings and then he just, like Kip said, a little flourish here and there with his own hand. And then he considers them, I guess, unique and his own, you know, one of a kind. But then they're not really one of a kind. There's a bunch of them, and he sells them for a lot of money.
Yeah, it's almost like autographing books.
And then also, part of the idea with art, if it's great art, then it's supposed to be on the cutting edge, like with great anything, great classical music or what have you. And in theory, then, it's not going to be digestible for most people. It's going to be sort of only speak to a tiny group that has the knowledge to appreciate what's going on.
Right.
So for someone to sell a billion paintings, it's because it's not doing that. It's it's everybody loves it. The subject matter is simplistic. So then the real artists hate it.
Right.
Because here's this guy who isn't making real art at all, but he's making a boatload of money from it.
But isn't, I mean, maybe you can do both though, because a lot of great movies do both. You know, like the Avengers or something like that. There's like this very surface level value. But then if you, like, know comics and you know, like, the art and the design and stuff and, like where the character development has come from, there's all these little nods with hidden in the movie. So there is a way to do both, which is kind of cool to think about.
Yeah, but it might be harder.
Thomas Kincaid is not doing it.
Might be harder in painting and stuff. But, yeah, I agree. I think there is a way of hitting kind of two levels at the same time. Even like a South Park is an example of where you can kind of just watch it for like the fart jokes and like a simple puerile humor, but there's also an incredible searing intelligence too.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can watch it for that at the same time.
Yeah,
I think Howard Stern is a lot like that. There's like just retarded stuff you can giggle at, but then there are like these really interesting probing questions too. So maybe there's a way of doing visual art where it's challenging on one level, but also, you know, appeals to the masses too.
Yeah. So all the social classes can enjoy it together.
Everybody, yeah. Everybody can come together and love it.
I think they do. I think they go to the movies to do that. It's yeah, really interesting.
For sure. Movies and probably video games too. Yeah. That's the real mass art of this era.
Yeah.
And it's something that it's kind of unfortunate for me because I'm not really into either one.
We should get a video game artist on the podcast and interview them about this.
That'd be really interesting.
That would be really interesting to think about because they probably put way more time and thought into that idea than we have.
Yeah, I've got one friend I might be able to ask.
Really? Well, that'd be cool. Let's get him or her. So,
yeah.
All right, everybody. That is going to conclude episode 27.
27.
Oh, yeah.
Ain't that crazy? Ain't that crazy? We're coming up on 30.
We're coming up. Oh, my.
The big 3-0.
Oh, my God. Just like me.
It's going to match Kip, who just recently turned 30.
I'm old.
No, you're still young. You still got a couple more.
Don't argue with me.
Two more decades before you're old.
Don't argue with me. I'm old.
All right, you're old.
Yeah,
I can see gray hair from here.
I have gray hair in my beard. Anyway, everybody. All right, that ends episode 27 of the Midwestern Social Scientists. I'm Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
And this is Keith McIntosh.
And here comes Kelsey with our little Facebook ad.
Hey, guys, if you enjoyed the show, check out Kip and Keith on Facebook at Midwestern Social Scientists. You can also tweet them at hashtag Midwestern Social Scientists. Or you can check out their Podomatic page, which is the first place the episodes get released. Don't miss out. Yeah, just check out their Facebook, okay? Thanks.